Hi, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
La-di-da, la-di-da.
He's looking at you, kid.
Let's put a smile on that face.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
It's Midday at the Movies. In 2015, it was Oscars So White, but 2016 is shaping up to be a banner year for film artists of color. In a recent essay in the Washington Post, film critic Ann Hornaday asks, is the term black film obsolete? Ann Hornaday joins me, along with Jed Dietz, the director of the Maryland Film Festival. We'll talk about movies like Moonlight, the critically acclaimed coming-of-age new release by Barry Jenkins. Is it part of what some are calling a revolution in black cinema? Moonlight and other movies you won't want to miss. The Midday Monthly Movie Mayhem coming right up after the news. And welcome to Midday. Around the country, people are actually saying, hooray for Chicago. But here on Midday, we're old-fashioned. We kick it old school. The first Friday of the month, we say, hooray for Hollywood. Jed Dietz of the Maryland Film Festival and Ann Hornaday, the film critic for the Washington Post, join us in the studio. How you guys doing?
Pretty good.
Great.
Pretty well, thank you.
So we're going to talk movies today. You are welcome to join us as well. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wipr.org, and you can send us a tweet. Our handle is @MiddayTomHall. So we want to talk about a bunch of things, in particular an essay, Anne, that you wrote in the Post a couple days ago about this, what some people are really calling, you know, this revolution in black cinema, this incredible moment of filmmakers of color rising to the fore. In particular, there's this movie called Moonlight, which I hope to see this weekend, as a matter of fact. So what inspired this essay? I mean, there's a lot of stuff out there now from filmmakers of color, aren't there?
Yeah, it's been a very interesting year, starting in January, you know, when Oscar nominations were announced. And, of course, there were no black filmmakers or actors in the main nominations, or any nominations for that matter. So, you know, there was a great deal of controversy, rightfully so, around that absence and perceived exclusion. And then came Sundance and Nate Parker's movie, The Birth of a Nation, which was purchased for a record amount of money, largely, I think, the studio thinking they would leverage off of that absence and say, and kind of bring to the world and bring to awards season this wonderful example of African-American film, you know, a film by, about African-American people. And kind of, I think, putting undue pressure on that film as being kind of the one, you know, the movie that will kind of save the day and prove Hollywood wrong. And sort of unbeknownst to them, you know, in the pipeline all along have just been these amazing films of this wonderfully diverse spectrum of voices and visions and storytelling styles and stories themselves, and Moonlight being a wonderful example of it, that really, you know, I think that come awards time, you know, there are going to just be so many films in that mix that were either made by African-American filmmakers or about African-American stories, that it's just really heartening. And Barry Jenkins, who wrote and directed Moonlight, was in Washington last week, and I got a chance to talk to him. And what really prompted the essay was the fact that in two weekends in a running, the two biggest movies in America were the new Madea movie, which has been the mainstream box office champ, and Moonlight, which has been the art house box office champ.
And Madea is this one of the Tyler Perry franchise
Correct.
Movies. I mean, she's
very lowbrow burlesque.
She is a character that Tyler Perry developed many years ago and has
Right.
been doing movies
and
ever since.
Exactly. And so my sort of premise was, and over the years, as I've written about African-American film and filmmakers, I've received some feedback from readers saying, you know, the term black film can feel really patronizing. It can feel reductive, limiting. And a little marginalizing, and I completely take their point. And so I wanted to talk to Barry about, like, in an age when we have this wonderfully now, thank goodness, we don't have the one anymore. We don't have the only one-ism that we suffered under for so long. We're really, I think, seeing a multiplying of voices and visions so that they can just be movies, and I think that's what we all want.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, Jed Ann asked the question in this essay, is the term black film obsolete? What do you think?
I doubt that it's obsolete yet. I mean, we have big issues in this country. The wonderful thing that I think Ann is observing, and I can vouch for because of a screening this week at the Charles where Moonlight is opening that DeRay McKesson hosted, that conversation is now being enhanced through film in a way that I don't think any other medium can actually play the role that film is now playing. And I would just underscore Anne's point. I mean, there are examples out and coming, but this Moonlight is part of a cultural discussion, and I would argue it was adapted from a play. I could only argue that the writer director Barry Jenkins, who was at the festival with his first film called Medicine for Melancholy, this could have only been written by an African American man. I mean, it's a part of a very, very specific part of our culture, our whole American culture, that had to be expressed from the inside, and we'll start a discussion. And that night that DeRay, the screening that was at the Charles in anticipation of this opening that DeRay hosted, evoked some of the most poignant testimony after the film from the audience. And I just think, yeah, I mean, the film ended and that discussion started, just as you would hope. So I think we're at the very beginning of it, actually. Yeah. So I think black film, there will be black film continuing. I think Anne's point is also right, which it will have is becoming a multiplicity of film that, we thought it was maybe only one thing for a while, and you would look for one black actor or one black director making an example of something. And I think that door is being blown open, right. I mean, almost literally as we speak.
Yeah. And by the way, I agree. I don't think it's obsolete. I posed the question, but Barry answered it exactly the same way. It would be naive, to think that it would be obsolete.
I mean, since President Obama was elected, people have been yearning for this
post-racial
society.
Exactly. Right. So I don't want anyone to mistake me for someone who believes that. I don't believe it. I don't think it's true in life, and I don't think it's true in film. But I do. But it, I thought it was, I thought it was at least interesting to entertain the idea.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about Moonlight in particular for folks who haven't seen the movie, like moi. what's it about? What's the story? And how good as a movie, whether it's a black film or not, mm-hmm. As a movie, how is it?
Oh, it's magnificent. It's about a young man coming of age in Miami in the Liberty City neighborhood, which is a poor neighborhood, crime-ridden. He's dealing with a lot of issues that are adjacent to poverty and racism, including crime, drug use, a crumbling education system. And he's also grappling with his own emerging sexual orientation and sort of social expectations of masculinity and definitions of masculinity that he is trying to navigate and push against. And one of the, because of his home, a sort of fractured home life, he comes under the protection and tutelage of a wonderful father figure played by Mayor Shala Ali in just a transcendent performance, who is an unlikely mentor. I don't want to give too much away. But just their relationship, all of these, it really upends a lot of your expectations of how things are going to go for this kid. It's told in three chapters. It's a very specifically structured film. It's not a typical narrative film with a beginning, middle, and end. Jenkins mm-hmm. tells this as three distinct chapters of this boy's life with three different actors, and three other actors playing his best friend with whom he has a relationship. And it's just visually... as pure cinema, it's absolutely, like I said, it's just magnificent. And then emotionally, it Barry and I were talking, and he said, unlike Medicine for Melancholy, which I just adored, he said this movie is really affecting viewers on a level that he even is surprised by, in that it seems to reach out to people in a way that surprises him because it is so very specific. And he did grow up in that community, so for him, it's second nature. But he's surprised at the degree to which This is reaching out toward people, and they're reaching back toward it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just achieving a level of communication and connection that is just, it's really quite lovely.
And Jed Ann is not the only film critic to think that Medicine for Melancholy was a terrific movie.
Yep.
Released the year that President Obama was elected, right. 2008, stars Wyatt Cenac, the guy who we all know mostly from the Jon Stewart show.
Right.
Very funny guy, very good actor. I haven't seen the movie, but in terms of the development of filmmaking from 2008 to now for Mr. Jenkins in this latest movie, Moonlight, what do you think?
I agree totally with Anne. I mean, I think everything she said is exactly right, that the cultural, sociological specifics in the movie are, I think, groundbreaking, really extraordinary. But it's an incredibly entertaining movie. I mean, it's the filmmaking is from the opening scene is to the closing scene. The choices he's made are extraordinary. The surprises within scenes, you know, if you're coming out of the white culture and probably middle-class black culture, you will have some thoughts about where a scene is going. I guarantee you in most of those scenes, that's not where it's going. And these characters are so specific. The casting is unbelievable. It's just a momentous piece of work. And, you know, what he started in Medicine for Melancholy, this is, as you pointed out, you know, 10 years later, or 8 years later, sorry, he's, you know, doing his second film. And right choice, you know. And one of the things that's very hopeful to me, we'll find out as it goes a little wider this weekend, opening the Charles tonight. And I think it's going to open it at Arundel Mills also. So it's a very interesting distribution pattern.
Not typical indie distribution.
Well,
right?
It's a small distributor with not huge resources, A24, and they've handled this so beautifully. I mean, the numbers are incredible. They had the biggest first screen last weekend of any movie that came out that was running, and we'll see where it goes from here. But I think it could really blow up, and I think it deserves it. It came out at Telluride and TIFF, the festivals that are sort of launched into the fall and award season, with unbelievable response from everybody, viewers and critics. And we'll see where it goes from here, but I would run to see it.
Yeah. Interesting. I mean, Anne, you point out in your piece that between those two movies, Moonlight, the sort of the indie movie, and Madea, Madea Halloween, that was the movie last weekend. Between the two of them, they raked in $17.5 million. That's a lot of money, just those two movies.
Right, exactly. And just that weekend.
Yeah, led the weekend.
Right,
I mean, that's really quite extraordinary.
It is extraordinary.
Now, so for Tyler Perry, who has this franchise that, you know, as we mentioned, there's all these Madea movies and stuff. I mean, it's an amazing character. It's very funny. But you just got to wonder, can a character like that stay funny for, I don't know, how many movies is this?
They're going to sure find out, I'll tell you that much.
But he has also just established this ginormous film studio. Isn't it Atlanta or someplace?
Yes, absolutely.
You know, I mean, he's incredibly successful. First of all, the first thing that strikes me, If a distributor is distributing a movie called Boo, a Madea Halloween, is there any shelf life on a movie like that past the 31st of October?
Oh, I think Perry has developed such a following and such a devoted following that it would be, you know, well, and of course now, granted, I have not seen the film, but I think I would venture to say, yes, it does have a shelf life in terms of just comedy. You know, it's like the same way that Halloween, the horror film, has shelf life. You know, I mean, it has a thematic hook, but you're really there just to see him and see the crazy burlesque, you know, the humor. And Lionsgate, who is the distributor, just signed him for two more because, I mean, it's just been a phenomenon. But I think he kind of embodies, over the years, I've spoken a lot with Ava DuVernay, who's a part of this story, of the last, and, you know, not in a cause and effect way, but it really has, it has coincided with the Obama years. You can't help but notice that it's in the last 8 years that these filmmakers have really come into their own, both in
movies and
television.
But so did Oscars So White coincide with the Obama years.
Exactly. Well, 2015. That's why it was so jarring. It was because everybody knew. But I think that what we see is that it, movies are cyclical. Things take a while to get made. You know, so even during Oscars So White, these things were in the pipeline. Yeah. It's not like these were all responses to that. No,
right.
They had been in the making for years. So.
Yeah.
So I think that a bigger structural change is afoot. But I think Ava has always advocated for autonomy, just saying, like, don't wait for permission, right? Don't wait for Hollywood to – don't waste
Ava
your
DuVernay
energy.
Who
made Selma.
Selma.
And the wonderful documentary 13th, which I hope we can maybe talk about today if people have seen it. It's on Netflix. But while it's important to knock on the doors and keep knocking on the doors, don't waste all, you know, I think she's telling artists, do it yourself. Like, just make your own luck and make your own. And Barry said this as well. The means of production are now more accessible so that you really, people can take it into their own hands. And Tyler Perry is a real embodiment of that principle.
Yeah. I mean, he makes a point, which you quote in your piece, that both Terrell, the playwright of whom this movie is based, and he, Barry, were born poor.
Oh yeah.
Yet they are in a situation now, and we've talked about this a bunch of times on the phone, that the equipment you need to make a movie isn't nearly as expensive as it used to be.
True. And then the distribution platform is
also blowing open,
or the exhibition platforms. Yeah.
Interesting stuff. Okay, we're going to take a little bit break, but we will come back shortly. And coming up, when we do, just in time for the election, who's your favorite movie president? Your movie president favorite. So give us a call with the actor who gets your vote for the number one cinematic POTUS. You can call us at 410-662-8780. You can drop us a tweet at Midday Tom Hall or an email midday@wypr.org. Glad you're with us. Jed Dietz from the Maryland Film Festival and Anne Hornaday from the Washington Post are as well. Stick around. We'll be right back.
This is your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back to the monthly Midday Movie Mayhem. I'm Tom Hall, joined in the studio by Jed Dietz of the Maryland Film Festival and Anne Hornaday of the Washington Post. By the way, coming up Monday on Midday, in anticipation of Veterans Day next week, Jeffrey Kendrick joins me to talk about the Maryland Center for Veterans Education and Training. It's an organization that provides education, housing, and counseling services to homeless veterans. We'll also talk, we hope, to a vet who is currently a student at the McVet Center in Baltimore to see how he's doing and to get a sense of the challenges that many vets face when they return to civilian life. I'll also speak with Brad Snyder. He's a retired U.S. Navy lieutenant who lost his sight during a second tour of duty in Afghanistan. Exactly 1 year after that happened, he won 2 gold medals in swimming in the London Paralympic Games. And this past summer in Rio, he added 3 more gold medals to his collection. He's written a book called Fire in My Eyes, An American Warrior's Journey, and that's all coming up on Midday Monday. And it's an amazing story. Looking forward to meeting Lieutenant Snyder. Today, if you've just joined us, it is, as I said, the monthly Midday Movie Mayhem. Our cinematic scholars Anne Hornaday of the Washington Post and Jed Dietz, the director of the Maryland Film Festival, join me here in Studio A. You can join us as well. Give us a call, 410-662-8780. You can drop us an email, midday@wypr.org, or send us a tweet. Our handle is @MiddayTomHall. So, Anne, you have an event you're doing Saturday, tomorrow, at the museum in Washington, and it's about cinematic portrayals of presidents.
Yeah.
This is kind of a fun thing,
it
just in time
really
for the
fun
election. So what's that all about? What's that
going to
entail?
My dear friend Arch Campbell, who's sort of the dean of the film critic community down in Washington, and Bill Newcott, who does the Movies for Grownups column and screenings for AARP, we got together and did a similar program a few months ago about baby boomer movies. And it was such a big hit that we decided to get the band back together. And since it's election season, we thought, well, let's talk about our favorite movie presidents. And I'm not going to give anything away because you have to come to the museum tomorrow and find out who we picked. But we show a few clips and talk a little bit and have a few laughs, and the audience gets involved, and we have a good time.
All right. Well, we have a
couple. It's at 2:30 tomorrow at the museum.
2:30 tomorrow at the museum in D.C. on Pennsylvania Avenue. So here's one contender.
Mm-hmm.
This is from Frost Nixon, which is the depiction of the interviews that David Frost did with Richard Nixon after he resigned from office. Nixon is played by Frank Langella, and David Frost played by Michael Sheen. This is a little clip from that movie, contender number one on favorite POTUS.
Look, when you're in office, you gotta do a lot of things sometimes that are not always, in the strictest sense of the law, legal. But you do them because they're in the greater interests of the nation.
Right, wait, just so I understand correctly. Are you really saying that in certain situations, the president can decide whether it's in the best interests of the nation, and then do something illegal.
I'm saying that when the president does it, that means it's not illegal.
It's not illegal.
Oh, man.
I think that's a direct quote, too.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right.
Yeah, I mean, there obviously is a transcript of those. John is on the phone from Phoenix, Maryland. You've got a contender for your favorite movie, POTUS. John, welcome to Midday with Jed Dietz and Ann Hornaday.
Yes, good afternoon. The name of this contender is The Contender, and it's Jeff Bridges.
Great choice.
Jeff Bridges in
The
Contender.
He was wonderful.
He was good?
Yeah.
And Joan Allen's in that book, or in that movie, Gary Oldman.
Yeah, Gary Oldman.
Ah.
I'm trying to fit the Big Lebowski and the presidency in my own head right now.
You want the dude in the Oval Office.
So Jeff Bridges is pretty convincing for you, hey John, and as a president?
Oh, yeah. He eviscerates Oldham toward the tail end of the movie.
Yeah, in that part. And then she's, what is she?
Well, great, John. Thank you so much for the call. It's a great suggestion.
And was she his vice president selection? Is that, I can't remember now. What was she up for, a cabinet position or the vice president? No, obviously, if he's the president, he already has a vice president.
Yeah, he has a vice president.
That was a great movie, though.
So, for example, if I were there tomorrow, could I vote for the president of the fraternity in Animal House? Or does it have to be the president of the United States?
I don't think we're going to be seeing many of those.
That's the only president that I remember.
But, we played the Frost-Nixon clip, and there have been Nixon is a hugely popular there have been a lot of cinematic depictions of Nixon.
I mean, come on.
If you're
an actor.
Low-hanging fruit.
Right, exactly.
But what that clip really reinforces for me is that what Langella did in that role was not impersonate. That was not an impersonation at all. I mean, he wasn't trying to get the voice down. He didn't try to get the physicality down. But I was at the Middleburg Film Festival in October, and David Gergen was doing a little panel on movie presidents, the very same topic. And of all of the Nixon depictions he has seen, he thought Langella's was the most on point. And he, of course, worked for Nixon, so he's in a good position. Mm-hmm.
We have another Nixon, as a matter of fact. This is Anthony Hopkins.
You have a responsibility, if you're against the candidate, to give him the shaft. But if you do that, at least put one lonely reporter on the campaign and we'll report what the candidate says now and then. I think, all in all, I've given as good as I've taken. But as I leave you, I want you to know, just think what you're going to be missing. You won't have Nixon to kick around anymore.
It's definitely a direct quote, but it certainly gets the nomination for Best Presidential Press Conference Scary Music. Can you imagine if, the White House press room, pipe that in behind, Josh Earnest? I mean, that would be something else. Leonard from Pikesville, welcome to Midday with Jed Dietz and Ann Hornaday. Who's your pick for Best Presidential Depiction in a Movie?
My depiction would be Daniel Day-Lewis as Lincoln.
That's an excellent idea. He was terrific. What do you think it was about Daniel Day-Lewis? I mean, when I saw that movie, I was intrigued because if his physicality was right, if his inflection, if his, just general countenance was right, I learned a lot about the personality of Abraham Lincoln. Did you have the same kind of experience?
I definitely agree with his physicality, his depth, the emotion he showed, just his presence. That did it for me. I think he really got in character. You can feel that it was definitely Lincoln as he would walk around at night, with his insomnia. I thought it was phenomenal.
Yeah, that's a great suggestion, Leonard. Thank you so much for the call. So, Jed, it's interesting when it comes to people like Nixon. We laugh about it being old, low-hanging fruit, but we're all old enough to remember when Nixon was in office. I mean, I was a child when Nixon lost the gubernatorial election to Pat Brown, but that was the press conference. He'd lost for governor of California.
Right.
And you won't have Nixon to kick around anymore. Of course, we did have Nixon to kick around a lot more.
He kicked back.
Back. But because particularly while he was in office, every comedian in the world was doing impressions of Nixon.
Yeah.
So I would imagine that would set some kind of bar for actors doing him in movies.
Well, except that the material is so great. I mean, like, cartoonists loved him too because his features were so easily extended and made into signature cartoon things, David Levine and many others. I think the thing that's so remarkable about the Lincoln portrayal, and that's a great choice, is, of course, except for still photographs, which were very new at the time, Daniel Day-Lewis had to, all the research had to be evocative from the printed page, and that's what he did. I mean, he did a huge amount of research on exactly the kind of clothes he wore and the material and where he bought them, and then lots of testimony from people who had worked with him, some of whom hated him. You know, he was a vilified president at the time, being compared to a monkey, and I mean, really unbelievable language around him. And Daniel Day-Lewis digested all of that. So I mean, we don't know, of course, because there isn't anybody alive who saw Lincoln move around, and certainly not alone in the White House. But it's a great choice. I think it's an extraordinary performance, and
you know,
and it makes you feel like you've gotten to know him a little bit.
Like, you know, yeah, totally. That's how it made me feel, for sure.
I happened to interview Tony Kushner, who wrote Lincoln. Mm. And
Steven Spielberg. Playwright.
Yes, yeah. Oh, wonderful playwright. And Spielberg. And Kushner told me that one of the ways that Day-Lewis built that performance was the insight it was discovering, and then using that discovery as an insight, that Lincoln was a huge theater fan, to his ultimate detriment, of course. But that he liked theater, he liked theatricality, he liked theatrical delivery. So when you see him give the second inaugural in Lincoln, he's kind of corny. You know, he has that kind of, he indicates a little bit with his gestures, and they're a little hammy. And that's a very subtle pickup of the fact that that was part of Lincoln's character, that he might well have kind of tried to, you know, give some flourishes to his speaking style and delivery, which I thought was just a really interesting, subtle.
Yeah,
it's just part of the acting process.
Anne Hornaday is a film critic for The Washington Post. Jed Dietz is the founder and director of the Maryland Film Festival. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us for the Midday Movie Mayhem. Join us at 410-662-8780. You can drop us a tweet at Midday Tom Hall, or send us an email, midday@wypr.org. If you have any suggestions you'd like to offer, in particular about favorite presidential depictions in cinema. One question that arises is, have the portrayals of presidents affected our notion of what a president should be? I think about the West Wing and Martin Sheen, or House of Cards with Kevin Spacey, where he's this terrible, you know, Machiavellian character. Everybody wanted Martin Sheen to be the president when he was on television in Aaron Sorkin's script. We've even had movies, I mean, some of them go way back. There was a movie in the 60s in which there was a woman president. You know?
Yes.
And the focus of that movie was her poor
Male anxiety.
Husband.
Yeah.
You know, the whole thing, I mean, what do I do now that my wife is the president? How do you think?
And James Earl Jones played the first black president in a movie called The Man.
Yeah.
Too,
so. So, I mean, what do you think? Does it move the needle at all for, you know, our expectation of what an actual president should be?
It's got to, right? I mean, I think, and maybe in a more generic way, even, you know, portrayals of various kinds of leaders, you know, Winston Churchill being portrayed, or, for sure. We're not there every day in those meetings, and to sort of be able to imagine it through the power of movie making and great acting has to move the needle some.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when Obama was elected, a lot of people did point to popular culture, both movies and especially television, as kind of preparing people psychically, you know, just kind of claiming our imagination and our collective imagination for, like, oh, yeah, that actually could happen. And it looks, you know, we can accept the iconography of it.
Yeah, and movies are certainly way ahead of what happens in actuality, which is interesting.
Sometimes.
I mean, you know, sometimes. I mean, James Earl Jones was way ahead of Obama, right, in 2008.
Yeah.
And women presidents are, of course, now there's...
We haven't seen as many female, you know.
Right.
It's interesting that it's more of a thing. You know, it's more of an issue. With black, you know, with the portrayals of African-American presidents, it was, as it should have, you know, it was very offhanded. That wasn't the point of the story.
John in Cockeysville, welcome to Midday. You've got a really great suggestion as to a favorite presidential cinematic depiction.
Hello?
Hi, John. You're on the air.
I don't know whether it was a movie, but I saw it All the Way with Bryan Cranston, LBJ.
Fabulous.
Right. It was filmed.
Yeah, it was on stage originally and then filmed.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's been on HBO.
Yeah, HBO.
It is a fantastic portrayal showing how politics with all its warts is done. And it was a pivotal moment in our history.
Indeed, that's a great suggestion,
great
John.
Choice.
Thank you for your call. I mean, the thing is that even for figures, you know, like Nixon, who ultimately was demonized for his, you know, during his demise, during and after his demise, the portrayals by an actor probably make us feel a little bit more empathic to all of these figures. I mean, we do see them, as John says, with warts and all, and we can identify with the warts because Lord knows we all got them. Yeah.
I think that's very true. Yeah. And poor old Johnson's sort of gotten it in the neck over the years between JFK and and some people feel Selma wasn't fair to him. And I
would be in that group. I don't think it was. I like Selma a lot, but I think that was a really unfair portrayal.
Right. I mean, I think there was one cut and one edit that I thought was unfair, but on the whole, I thought it. And as a matter of fact, it's interesting to watch All the Way and Selma together because I think they're kind of a piece in terms of showing the pressures he was under and. You know, just understanding all of the different balls
he's
trying to juggle.
It is interesting because he seems like low-hanging fruit, too, a real caricature of a man, you know, a huge figure. And yet, I would say he's been the hardest to capture for actors. He's been portrayed multiple times now on stage and in film. And I still think the most entertaining portrayal is Lyndon Johnson himself on those tapes as he was calling politicians around the country on election night. They're now all in the LBJ library and sometimes released.
And on C-SPAN radio every Sunday night.
They're just unbelievable. Yeah. I mean,
His calls with Jacqueline Kennedy.
Yeah. And it's what John just mentioned. I mean, you see him moving the levers of power, and it's just fascinating to me.
Yeah. And I might suggest the actor whose name I don't know because I've forgotten it, who plays Barack Obama as a young community organizer in Southside With You, which I love the movie.
That's a great one.
And it was way before he was even thinking maybe about being the president. But boy, that portrayal, again, you got this notion of these two people who are just red hot in love with each other. You can tell. I mean, you know.
or on their way.
It's fascinating, I mean, to sort of, you know, imagine, because that's what the filmmaker did. I mean, the Obamas did not participate in this movie in any way.
Right.
But they just sort of imagined, what was it like?
Yeah, both of them.
When they're basically on their first date.
Yep.
Wonderful movie.
So here's another suggestion. This is from Charlotte. This is an email that we've gotten from Charlotte, who says, Dave. Which is the 1993 comedy with Kevin Kline playing Dave Kovic. And was he the president in that movie?
Yep.
I don't remember that movie. Yeah.
And it partially filmed in Baltimore, actually. There's a whole scene at Camden Yards.
So Kevin Kline. Yeah. Thank you, Charlotte. That's a great, great idea. So, I mean, there's a lot of them out there.
Yeah, it's kind of...
You all have to pick the top 10 on tomorrow.
Yeah, right? And I think... And we took our job... We gave ourselves creative license within that. So you'll come and see what we did. We threw in a few little left curves there. Because it is. There's just so many interesting ways to think about it. And we tried to be a little counterintuitive.
But I think... Some beans were spilled here. Probably no fraternity house president.
Probably not.
Why didn't I think of that?
There you go. Well, it's because you're smart and I'm not. The real question is, why did I think of that? But what I hope is that, you know, portrayals of the presidency like in House of Cards, in which Spacey is such a cynical, malicious, you know, prevaricating character, that it doesn't feed into the cynicism about government. I mean, here this Langella clip when we hear him, you know, well, if the president does it, it's not illegal. Well, you know, we're in the middle of a campaign now where, you know, there's potential illegality on the part of both major candidates. I mean, we don't know a lot. There's been these allegations, and that's the only reason I would say potential. I mean, there's no charges, no crimes anybody being accused of actual crimes, but this is a very tight race because Secretary Clinton has been, you know, implicated, and most, you know, the common wisdom is it wouldn't be so tight were those implications not out there in the public domain. So I don't know. Let's hope that it's it doesn't make everybody as cynical as can be.
Yeah, and I do think those are you've raised a really good question. I mean, I think the level of cynicism probably has been impacted by the huge popularity of House of Cards. I mean, I certainly in history, there's no equivalent of any accusation, even the most outrageous accusations in this campaign. There's nothing even remotely close to Watergate, in which, you know, I don't know, 40 staffers went to, you know, were convicted and many went to jail. A president had to leave office. And there was for sure criminal activity there and potentially threatening the Constitution of the United States, actually. And there's certainly nothing on the table now, but there is some art that's at that level. And that's an interesting question.
Jed Dietz is the founder and director of the Maryland Film Festival and Hornaday, the film critic for The Washington Post. We will come back in just a bit and get your suggestions, not only for movies about presidents. We can put that to rest if you'd like, but tell us what you've seen recently that you really like. Tell us what you've been to the movies to catch and which ones you think are worth sharing with everybody else. Our number 410-662-8780. Our email midday@wypr.org and send us a tweet @MiddayTomHall. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Midday here on your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back, everybody. It's the monthly Midday Movie Mayhem. I'm Tom Hall, going through my annual or my monthly period of regret that neither of my names begins with the letter M. So I cannot contribute at all to that hideous and painful alliteration. But Jed Dietz from the Maryland Film Festival is here. Ann Hornaday, the film critic for the Washington Post, is here. You can be here as well. Our telephone number, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. And our Twitter handle is @MiddayTomHall. So, Jed, let's talk about an event that you've got a week from tomorrow, the 12th of November. It's part of this series you have called Between the Scenes. This is an open conversation with a couple of directors who have, connections to the festival, and they're doing some interesting work. So what's that going to be about?
Yeah, so the two directors that are coming in, Lige Kerrigan, who has had films at Cannes and various other festivals, he's directed Homeland. He's one of the showrunners, writer-director of this new series on Starz. It's gotten a great deal of attention, called The Girlfriend Experience. And then Marielle Heller, who has just started a film career with a film that got great attention both at Sundance and the new director series at MoMA, called Diary of a Teenage Girl. And she's about to start directing another feature for Fox Searchlight. And she's directed for Amazon. She's directed Transparent. So and Matt Porterfield, who is an emerging filmmaker who based here in Baltimore, has made a series of films, just finished shooting a film called Solar's Point, his new film, will moderate. And the issue on the table is what you said earlier, as the ability to make film has literally now fully democratized. Anybody could go make a movie with really good equipment that's accessible, completely new in the last, you know, handful of years. And now even getting them to audiences, that world has exploded with, you know, Netflix wasn't even in the production world just a few years ago and has now got one of the biggest production budgets ever known for filmmaking. How does this new world look to a filmmaker? You know, is it, from a consumer standpoint, I will tell you, I think it's just unquestionably exciting. And, you know, whatever the screens are, you know, in a theater, always the best way, I think, to see a movie with an audience and all that projected and sound ideal. But, you know, I'm very happy that we can see films on our iPhones and our laptops.
And there are folks making movies now that you watch on your watch. I mean, literally, you could. There are projects that, you know, are assuming that people are going to be watching, you know, viewing the films literally on their wrists.
Well, I mean, there are major careers that exist only on YouTube. So that just, you're absolutely right. I mean, and I think there are 2 billion views a day of YouTube product, which are, I guess, by definition, each of them film, you know, a movie. But so that's what we want to explore with these filmmakers, and it's open to the public. We're not going to resolve it because this world is literally blowing wide open right now. But next Saturday we'll get at least some insight from the filmmaker standpoint.
Because Anne Hornady, it's interesting the rhetorical evolution, mm-hmm. stuff that was on TV, stuff like Netflix or Amazon or HBO or something, was never referred to as films.
Well, you just mentioned two things that aren't even TV: Netflix and Amazon. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
You
know? They could be computer only for many, many people. Yeah.
Well, they are. Yeah. They don't have a television. Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting.
I mean, I happen to watch Netflix and Amazon on my television set, but my daughter doesn't.
Exactly.
I mean, she has never known a TV.
That's why these terms, it is, I think it is really flattening out. I remember when I was freelancing in New York. It was at the beginning of when HBO was commissioning films, original films, and they were using a lot of golden age. You know, they were using directors like Robert Mulligan and John Frankenheimer, who were kind of on the downward slopes of their careers. And it was seen then as kind of a stigma, like, oh boy, you know, he's working for HBO, you know, and I think they were actually at the vanguard of what we've seen as this kind of very easy migration back and forth between these media and these platforms, to where, and certainly viewers are not distinguishing anymore.
No.
I do think that there is a cost. When you spoke of rhetoric, I thought you were going in a formal direction, which is something I'm a little. It's kind of a bugaboo, which is with the end use. So now being assumed to be an iPhone or maybe even a watch, the visual grammar of filmmaking has really changed. And I think that it's lost a lot of its monumentality and a lot of its scale, because you can't have those glorious David Lean, you know, establishing shots. That's not going to necessarily translate to a watch. So I kind of feel that the actual visual rhetoric of films has taken a hit. They've become kind of conglomerations of medium close-ups and close-ups and coverage, and you're out. And that's a little bit concerning to me. But I mean, there is still ambition, and Moonlight being a really great example of that. There are still filmmakers out there that are working at a scale and at a level that they're not compromising.
Speaking of Moonlight, which we were speaking of earlier in the show, let's play a little clip of this movie. We can't supply the visual grandeur here, but you can imagine that. Here's a clip from Moonlight.
What happened, Chiron? Why you didn't come home like you're supposed to? Huh? And who is you?
Nobody. I found him yesterday. Found him in a hole on 15. Yeah, that one. Some boys chased him in the cut. He scared more than anything. He wouldn't tell me where he lived till this morning.
Well, thanks for seeing to him. He usually can take care of himself.
That is some intense stuff.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
It's a great. I mean, just the sound is amazing. The visuals around that scene are extraordinary. This is Chiron in his youngest version, and it's a very scared mother, and it's
played by Naomi Harris in an absolutely stunning performance. And I want to also shout out Janelle Monáe, the singer, the wonderful musician, makes her feature debut in this movie, and she's also in an upcoming movie called Hidden Figures about a group of female mathematicians at NASA who helped the space program.
Who are African American.
And they showed some clips in Toronto of that, and she was smashing. And I just...
She's great in this, too.
She's great in this.
Yeah, Moonlight sounds like a must-see this weekend. We got a bunch more suggestions of presidential movies, and I got to read them because I think these are really great.
Why didn't I ask you people before I did that program?
Chris Reed, who knows an awful lot about film, sent us a tweet. He says he'd like to offer up Brian Keith in The Wind and the Lion. He played Teddy Roosevelt.
Oh, that's right.
That's a
Chris,
good one, Chris,
for The Wind.
Thank you very much.
Well done,
and,
sir.
Maria says Harrison Ford.
Oh, yeah.
And Air Force
you gotta
One.
Love it. Yeah.
Air Force One.
Give a mouse a cookie.
That's it. That's right. Give a mouse a cookie.
That was my favorite
line
in that
line?
Movie. Yeah, he just... I'll just leave that there.
Do you quote Shakespeare as well this morning? Today? Look forward to that.
Such a cute line.
Here's one. President Terry Crews plays President Camacho in Mike Judge's 2006 movie Idiocracy. This is from Joey. Says his name. I don't know that movie.
Oh, man. That's the one that you almost don't want to watch today because so much of it seems to be coming true.
That's exactly what he says. He said the lowest common denominator dystopian portrayal is eerily reminiscent of what we see in this election season. There you go. There you go. Here's another one from Tom Chalkley of media fame. James Garner and Jack Lemmon play ex-presidents, but he can't remember the name of the movie. Do you guys remember the name of the movie?
No.
Maybe some of our listeners remember. Jack Lemmon and James Garner.
Crowdsource this.
410-662-8780, midday at WIPR.org or at midday Tom Hall, if you know the answer. What's the name of the movie that featured James Garner and Jack Lemmon as ex-presidents? That's a good suggestion, Tom. Yeah. And then we have Chandra writes in and says Glenn Close as the VP in Air Force One.
Yes.
So she was
that was right.
A female.
You're right. Good point.
So good VP in Air Force One. It's the midday movie mayhem with Jed Dietz of the Maryland Film Festival and Anne Hornaday of the Washington Post. Let's talk about a couple of things that are in theaters besides Moonlight. One of them is a movie called Certain Women. Stars Laura Dern, Kristen Stewart, Michelle Williams, and Lily Gladstone. It's a small town in Montana, I think, something like that. Mm-hmm. Based on a story by, or a bunch of stories by Maile Malloy.
Yeah.
Anne Hornaday, what do you think?
Oh, I was really beguiled by this movie. It's by one of my very, very, very favorite filmmakers, Kelly Reichardt, who did Old Joy. She did Wendy and Lucy with Michelle Williams, Meek's Cut Off also with Michelle Williams. And here she, you know, for years she's been working with a screenwriter named John Raymond who wrote all of those movies. And they've just had an amazing collaboration. She actually wrote this herself. She adapted these stories. And like Moonlight, it's very similarly structured in terms of these three distinct stories that all, each about a different woman living in this town in Montana. Their lives overlap in ways that come to be clear. But it's just a very quiet, observant film about people in their environment and how that environment shapes their lives and how they're trying to kind of forge their identities against all, you know, some social expectations. But it's a very quiet, reflective movie that's really mostly about these performances because they're all fantastic. It's Kristen Stewart, I think,
best
at her best.
Best thing she's ever done.
I really
like her a lot.
Yeah, I do too.
She's really
wonderful.
Extraordinary.
And I just adore Michelle Williams. We'll talk about her next month with Manchester by the Sea because she's something very special.
By the way, Mr. Google called to tell us that My Fellow Americans is the name of the movie.
Oh, that's right. I do
remember Jack
that.
With Jack Lemmon and James Garner. Also features Dan Aykroyd.
I think I might have reviewed that.
There you go. You might. Well, thank you, Mr. Google, for that. One quick, we got about a minute left. I want to talk about a new doc that's out by a director named Jim Jarmusch called Gimme Danger. And this is about the punk band, The Stooges. Jed, what did you think?
Well, Jim Jarmusch is a legendary independent filmmaker. He's done many exciting films. This is, I think, the first doc he's ever made. And Iggy Pop as the central character is totally riveting in this movie. This is not a part of the music world. I certainly knew who Iggy Pop was, but it was not. I didn't know all the details of it. And I was saying to Anne before
air. Great doc, it sounds like.
As a parent, it was very reassuring because you see a character make a lot of bad choices and get through them all.
He's thriving. It's really quite wonderful.
All right. Well, thanks to you both. Always fun to see you guys. Anne Hornaday is the film critic for The Washington Post. She'll be part of a panel on the Inside Media series at the Museum in Washington, Hollywood's White House, the Top 10 Movie Presidents. That's tomorrow afternoon at 2:30. Jed Dietz, the founder and director of the Maryland Film Festival. They'll be moving to their new digs at the Parkway Theater in just a few months. Their next big event is an open conversation that's part of their Between the Screens series. It's a week from tomorrow, 12th of November at MICA. Features directors Lodge Kerrigan and Marielle Heller. We've got link to information about both of those events on our website, wipr.org/midday. That's it for us today. Coming up Monday, a conversation about helping homeless or formerly incarcerated veterans get back on their feet. Jeffrey Kendrick is the director of the Maryland Center for Veterans Education and Training. He'll be here and we'll also meet former U.S. Navy Lieutenant Brad Snyder, who became a gold medal Paralympic swimmer after losing his eyesight in a bomb blast in Afghanistan. Veterans Day is a week from today. We'll focus on vets Monday on Midday. Midday is produced by Rob Sivak, Bridget Armstrong, and Kathleen Cahill. Austin Coughlin from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Midday theme music. Our director and engineer is Luke Spicknall, who doubles as my fashion consultant. And I've got to say, ever since that started, I no longer or almost never wear paisley and plaid together. And I'm grateful to you, Luke. Thanks again for listening, everybody. I look forward to being with you next week. Remember to set your clocks tomorrow night and enjoy your extra hour of tomorrow. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great weekend. Congratulations, Cubbies.
This is your NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.